Robin Scott was 6 years old when her parents decided to move from the modern amenities of New Zealand to a converted cowshed in Botswana. From then on, her life took a number of unconventional turns, like when she amused herself with poisonous snakes and other animals in the bush. She recently published a memoir about her unusual childhood called 20 Chickens for a Saddle, and had brought her to the show earlier this year. We're going to play it again for you now. I began by asking Miss Scott if her dad had simply come home from work one day and said, "We're moving to Botswana."
He did, absolutely. It was about as simple as that. And
no advance warning?
I didn't have the advance warning. I suspect my mother did, but I was so little at the time.
And how did you feel about leaving New Zealand? Did you think it was a good idea? And would anybody have paid much attention to you? After all, you were only six.
Well, in terms of leaving, I think that age as a child is a wonderful time because one is so caught up in new things, and any possible regret at what we were leaving behind was quickly obliterated by the excitement of going. And my parents had such an infectious love of change that it was very hard to resent anything changing because they were so excited themselves.
It was an adventure.
Absolutely.
Had you been there before? Your grandparents were already there.
I hadn't. I was actually born in England and we moved to New Zealand when I was very small. So it was the first time my brother, sister and I had set foot in the country. My parents both grew up in Southern Africa, but it was a new world for us.
How did they wind up there? How did your grandparents wind up there? What were they doing?
Well, my paternal grandfather was an English South African, and he was actually a bomber pilot in the Second World War for the South African Army. And when he divorced my paternal grandmother, he sought new things in a new wild place. And he moved to Botswana in the early 60s, when it really was a very, very sparsely populated place with very little there. He was the pilot, the first pilot for Botswana's first president, Seretse Khama. And on my mother's side, my grandfather worked on the mines, and he was brought in from Zambia to be the personnel manager on the copper and nickel mine in a small mining town.
But your father was also a pilot, although, and a doctor.
He was. My grandfather taught all three of his sons. And in fact, my father came back to Botswana wanting to give up medicine altogether. He was getting very frustrated with it. He liked new pioneering things, and medicine after a while got to be too much of the same, I think. So he said, "We're going back to Botswana," but at the same time he said, "And I'm reinventing myself." And we got back, and kind of fate stepped in, because just before we had arrived, a flying doctor had died in Botswana, a very famous flying doctor there. And my father heard about this, and he suddenly thought, you know, flying, which was one of his passions, here was a way to reinvent the profession.
And I'm sure that the kinds of cases he was seeing in Botswana were quite different from the ones he was dealing with in New Zealand.
Absolutely. I think it was a steep learning curve for him. He practiced in very rural settings. He'd sort of land on dirt airstrips and work in one-room clinics. And he certainly had to come to terms with some different expectations of a doctor. And as children, we remembered and were fascinated by the fact he used to put food colouring in some of the liquid medicines, because there was a very strong belief that colourless medicines were completely ineffective. And my mother, it really upset my mother, but my dad was much more pragmatic. He said, "Look, this is a visual modification, and my patients will go away happier as a result."
And it's just food colouring.
It's just food colouring, after all.
Now, Botswana was already an independent country at this point?
Yes, it was never fully colonised. It was a British protectorate, but it got its independence in the 60s and has been long established as a very democratic place.
But it's north of South Africa, and South African politics spilled into Botswana. Was it segregated where you were growing up?
No, I mean, I was initially, at least for the first 5 years, we lived near the small mining town, and I mean, the country is largely colorblind. It's had a remarkable history because the first president, Sir Retsi Khama, married a white English woman. So the country is essentially colorblind. And in fact, his son, so a colored man, to use Southern African terminologies, in April became president in April. So there wasn't a color race issue initially, but when I was about 12, we moved to the border with South Africa, where we had some neighbors who very much still inhabited the apartheid mindset.
And even though apartheid had already been dismantled in South Africa by then.
Absolutely.
1990.
And in fact, I think a lot of the people who lived in this area in Botswana on the border were the very, very right-wing, most racist of the Afrikaans South Africans, who were very upset when apartheid did disappear. And we came across some really extraordinarily bigoted opinions. And it was a shock, having had this kind of cocoon.
Well, your mother was homeschooling you, in fact, even back in New Zealand, although I'm not exactly sure why. But did that that cut down on your ability to make friends with other kids?
It's difficult to know without having had the other side of the experience, but I don't think so. We lived very near a town, so we did a lot of other activities with children our own age. And certainly later on, when all three of us went to conventional schools, it wasn't really a problem. But it made us a little eccentric, I think.
Because the other kids saw you as having had, well, you must have come with a whole different set of facts and knowledge than the kids who had gone through the same school system. I don't know what your mother was teaching you.
Well, initially quite little. She took the view that learning should be indistinguishable from play. So we were basically given free rein. And because of the marvelous environment we were in, we got to do some wonderful things. We'd kind of go exploring in the bush for days, and we'd learn all the Latin names of trees. So we had these kind of eccentric areas of great knowledge. And then there were gaps, obviously.
But then you went to school with a lot of other kids. The transition must have been difficult. You also had a very British accent in a country where that might have stood out just a bit.
I suppose it did a bit, but my British accent, and I would argue it's not so British, but that was the least of the things.
It does not sound South African.
No, it's not South African. It's a hodgepodge of things. I think that was the least of the different things about me. And certainly I was different, but it's amazing. You always want what other people have. So everyone is incredibly envious that I didn't have to do homework. And I was desperate for homework by the time I went to school, because I really longed for the structure that we didn't have.
My guest is Robin Scott, who's written a marvelous memoir called 20 Chickens for a Saddle, the story of an African childhood. Did you plan to be a writer before you decided to write this memoir?
Not at all. I never considered it. I feel like I stumbled into this book. I was actually applying for a job at the Financial Times. I was nearing the end of a master's degree in business and science, and I wanted to do a bit of journalism. And I met a journalist who said she'd put in a good word for me if I wrote an article to show I could write. And I said, I'll do something on the pricing of medicines in developing countries, which was my thesis topic, thinking it's a nice, weighty FT subject. And she said, no, write about growing up in Botswana. And I was very surprised at it, but I did. And anyway, someone else later read the article and said, this isn't just an article, this is a book. And I initially thought it was impossible, but I have a stubborn streak in me, and I thought, I'm going to try, just to at least lay the opportunity to rest. And I still sometimes feel that it's kind of surreal being here now.
On the other hand, I'm sure that you enjoyed the process. It couldn't have been all that painful. You did complete the book. And sometimes people who write that kind of book discover that that's what they're going to do, and they start writing more books. Or are we going to start reading only books about economic matters from now on from you?
Well, I found it very difficult, but I did enjoy it ultimately a great deal, and it was a great thing for the whole family to actually write it, because we shared the memories again. In terms of
you and your siblings, or your mother and father,
and
as
my
well?
Mother and father, I took the view they must all see the material, because it's such a such recent history. So I think we all benefited from it. In terms of going forward, I swore when I was writing this I would never do another one, but I actually it also came of an article, but I'm writing a book on a group of maximum security prisoners in South Africa who've adopted AIDS orphans, who've done quite extraordinary things with them.
Well, your father was a doctor. When did he start seeing people with AIDS? Did he know what he was seeing at first?
I think the medical profession by that stage was kind of well aware of the problem. AIDS wasn't talked about. In the early 90s, I think it first started becoming prominent. The first case was reported in 85 in Botswana. But by mid to late 90s, my father was seeing a great deal of patients. He saw about 100 patients a day, and towards the end of the 90s, 50% of them had full-blown AIDS. It was huge numbers.
I have spoken to someone who's written a book about dealing with AIDS in South Africa, and there are all sorts of cultural problems that have made it harder to get full treatment for everyone who needs it. Was that a problem in Botswana as well?
There definitely were cultural issues, and for a long time it was seen as kind of not done to talk about it. And we actually came to know one of the first women who publicly said she had AIDS.
In fact, this writer said that women are much more likely to acknowledge it than men, which is part of the problem, because women are being treated, but men aren't necessarily.
Absolutely, and I'm no expert, but I think it is the case in Botswana. The good thing about Botswana is, while the government was slow to act, it ultimately became perhaps the best example in Africa of a government dealing with the disease, and it's engaged with the Gates Foundation, with drug companies, to make these drugs available to everyone.
This is also the story of your parents' marriage. Your mother is an extreme optimist, a real free spirit, always able to find a silver lining. Did you inherit any of that from her?
I think I did. I was quite a sort of serious, grumpy child, but she was very persuasive, and I think by now I've got a great deal of that, and it's stood me in very good stead, because things going wrong don't fluster me.
Your father's less of an optimist, but he was a pilot just like your grandfather. Ever think of becoming a pilot?
I certainly enjoyed flying when I was little, and we'd occasionally play with the controls. I at one stage entertained a desire to get a microlight license, but I haven't really seriously thought of being a pilot myself.
Where does your title 20 Chickens for a Saddle come from?
Well, this the story behind it kind of epitomizes my parents and their approach to life and their children. I was a passionate horse rider when I was little, and I was desperate to blend in with the local riding community, which did things in quite a proper way. And I had everything different. All my riding attire was different, and it caused me a great deal of embarrassment. And in particular, my saddle was kind of outlandish and old-fashioned. And I begged my parents for a new saddle. They said, "You don't need one. Yours is functional." Anyway, eventually my father said, "Well, you can earn some money to contribute. I will buy your saddle. But you have to think of a way to earn the money." So they were also both passionate about organic farming and animal welfare, and we're always talking about battery farming, etc. And through that, I got the idea to sell free-range eggs. So I got, for my birthday, I got 20 chickens, ex-battery chickens, which I rehabilitated and earned some money selling the eggs to contribute to the saddle.
The surprise at the end of the book is that your parents get divorced, because they do seem to have a fascinating marriage. This was not enough to keep them together, or is it the kids growing up?
I think it's Yes, I think it's a mixture of many things, but a lot of what my parents, the foundations for my parents' marriage was this extraordinary existence. They both liked doing things differently, and they kind of fed off each other in that passion. And at the end of the book, we leave Botswana, and they start a much more conventional life in Cape Town. And I think things just drifted apart. There wasn't that glue.
And you wound up in London.
I did.
Where people must think that you either are lying when you tell them some of the things that you experienced when you were a kid, or just see you as an incredible exotic.
Yes, I suppose there is a bit of that. But in the UK in particular, there's a really strong sense of affiliation to Southern Africa, I find. And a lot of people have travelled there. So I think people are surprised, but they don't see me as too far out. And I've also been to a university in New Zealand and then in the UK. So I've toned down my exoticness a bit.
You don't talk about playing with poison snakes when you were a kid.
I do. I do. I love telling people that story.
Meanwhile, you don't miss Botswana at all?
I do. I miss it a great deal, but I'm lucky enough to travel back to Southern Africa about 3 or 4 times a year. So I get
for
my
work?
Fix. Yeah, for work, for the research for the new book, and I also do some consulting work on carbon markets. And to see my family, of course.
Your family's now in South Africa.
Yeah. Well, my brother's in the UK.
Have you been able to visit your old home? Would you ever want to go back to that cow shed?
Yes, and last year I went back. It was an odd experience, but it was quite wonderful. And you know, everything changes, but everything stays the same. So all the lovely trees were still there.
There's that old song, "How You're Going to Keep Them Down on the Farm After They've Seen Paris." But I suspect that it also works the other way, doesn't it? That living in London sometimes feels a bit limiting when you had this incredibly free experience when you were growing up in a country that was kind of growing up at the same time.
Absolutely. I think, you know, a developed country is much more set in its ways. And Botswana, as my eccentric grandfather always used to say, is a land of opportunity. It's got none of the really bad things that you find elsewhere in Africa, but a lot of the good. So you did feel like there was infinite possibility. So I miss that.
And more interesting books written about it. Norman Rush has written a whole slew of books, and Alexander McCall Smith has written a bunch of books about Botswana, small as it is. How many people live there now?
It's fewer than 2 million, so it's very small. The country is the size of France, but two-thirds of it are desert. So it's only on the east it's really populated. But it's a gem, and it's a gem in Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.